Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to thank you all for this opportunity to give this talk today during this very exciting time in physics. We're actually using gravitational waves to gain new views on our universe. So I'm going to discuss some of the theoretical and computational work that we use to harness this new window into our universe and use it as a probe of fundamental physics that we might not be able to access with laboratories here on Earth. And I'll also tell you about how we can use these same tools to actually probe sort of the limits of our theoretical understanding of the dynamics of space-time at the same time that we're probing the limits observationally. So probably no reminder is necessary, but just to remind y'all, this whole field of gravitational wave astronomy got kicked off about 4 years ago with this detection that occurred on September 14th, 2015, where LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, detected the signal shown here, both in their instrument in Hanford, Washington, and in Livingston, Louisiana. And this gravitational wave signal that they detected actually corresponded to an event that occurred 1.3 billion years ago, where two black holes, each having a mass of about 30 times that of our sun, spiraled towards each other and merged, creating a bigger black hole and creating these ripples in the fabric of space-time, these gravitational waves, which propagated here on Earth where we detected them. And not only that, but this whole story of what black holes are, what happens when they merge, how they create these gravitational waves, was well described by the theory that Einstein wrote down almost exactly 100 years prior. So I'll go a little bit into how we actually know what the predictions of that theory are and how we can compare them to these observations. But you know, at this point, you know, this is sort of old news. The Nobel Prizes have been awarded. The books have been written. But in the meantime, LIGO has continued to make detections of gravitational waves and learned new things each time. So, and it also looks like that the black holes that we're observing in gravitational waves are actually different than the ones we're seeing that we've seen before. So that's depicted in this graphic here. It shows the mass of the black holes. And the ones detected by LIGO are the ones in blue, and they tend to be noticeably more massive than the ones in purple, which are the ones that we've seen with X-ray telescopes. And there are actually rumors that in the third observing run, which is going on now, even more massive black holes have been might have been seen, which might even strain current theories about how these black holes form from collapsing supernovae. So just a couple months ago, there was an announcement that LIGO had detected a second neutron star merger event. This is in addition to the one that was detected in 2017. And this one was particularly interesting because the total mass of the system was about 3.4 solar masses, which is large compared to all the binary neutron star systems in our own galaxy that we observed that will merge. So the latter is depicted by this distribution given by this black curve. And these orange and blue curves are the estimate of the total mass of the double neutron star system that is observed to merge. And the two different curves just correspond to different assumptions made about the spins of the neutron stars. So this could indicate some selection bias in our previous observations, or the fact, and or the fact that we're seeing a new population of binary neutron star systems. And maybe more speculative but intriguing possibility is that maybe these objects are not actually neutron stars themselves. Maybe they're black holes. So that cannot actually be ruled out from the gravitational wave signal itself. And for this system, it was about four times as far away as the first observed neutron star merger, and so no electromagnetic counterparts were seen for this system. So I'll return to that idea in a little bit.
So can I ask a question about this sort of statement?
Mm-hmm.
What was seen is what was seen, but it's easier to see more massive binaries farther away, and volume always wins. And so we would always be biased to the gravitational wave observations towards the most massive binaries that are there. So has that been folded into this question of, is this consistent?
I think so. I mean, you can see that this mass is sort of would be very much at the tail of this distribution, and it's not that, like, we're not talking about huge differences in masses, right? It's like 2.8 versus 3.4.
Histograms of distribution, and the dotted line is Gaussian fit, right?
Right, sure. So, but
I don't know what the tail is.
Yeah, well, I think it was estimated at like 4 or more sigma away. And the difference in mass is not really that significant, right? Yeah. But I think it is, I don't think it's just that effect. Yeah. Yeah, so what kind of events will LIGO see? So I already mentioned a couple of them. So LIGO is primarily meant to go after the merger of compact objects, such as black holes and neutron stars. So we call these objects compact because the sort of escape velocity you need to escape their gravitational pull is actually comparable to the speed of light. And so LIGO has already announced an order of 10 events corresponding to black holes merging with black holes, and has seen two neutron stars merging together. At least that's probably what they've seen. And there are some hints from the public announcements that perhaps LIGO may have seen events corresponding to a black hole merging with a neutron star. So as you can see in this comic, Ray Weiss is making rapid progress through sort of the LIGO checklist of different events. But in addition to these compact object mergers, there are a number of other sources that might be more rare or exotic, such as gravitational waves from stars collapsing and going supernovae, or maybe a stochastic background of gravitational waves from the early universe or otherwise. But there's also the possibility that, you know, with this new way of looking out into the universe, there'll be some surprises, perhaps even things that we, you know, didn't have the imagination to dream up. And so that, of course, would be a very exciting possibility. So, you know, how do we know what kind of gravitational wave systems to expect from a given source? Or as we started to do, and hopefully do a lot more in the future, given a gravitational wave detection, how do we understand what system gave rise to it? Well, in order to do that, we need to solve the system of equations that Einstein gave us. In particular, we want solutions describing the orbiting or merging or oscillating of strongly gravitating systems. So it's easy to write down solutions that describe individual black holes or neutron stars, but you know, again, you need dynamical things to give you gravitational waves. And there are various approximations that work when things are moving not too close to the speed of light, or systems are not too compact. But in something like the final stages of two black holes merging, all these approximations break down. And you really have no choice but to solve the full equations. And so actually, you know, what exactly the gravitational wave signal looked like from such a binary black hole merger was not something we knew until about 15 years ago. And so it turned out the solution was a sort of new numerical methods and algorithms and harnessing powerful supercomputers to work this out. And so, you know, that's the kind of work that I spend most of my time doing. And something that I find particularly compelling about this field of numerical relativity is that it's sort of, you know, going hand in hand with these amazing breakthroughs in the LIGO observations, it sort of allows you to go beyond your understanding of space-time that you know, first form when you learn general relativity. So, you know, when you first come across general relativity, you sort of think of black holes as these eternal stationary objects that don't really have dynamics of their own and that existed for all time. However, with the numerical GR, you can sort of make the equations come alive and consider black holes as dynamical objects in and of themselves. So here's just an example of that in a simulation of two neutron stars merging. I'm showing here the density of the matter. You can see the neutron stars circling each other. The orbit is shrinking as they lose energy to gravitational radiation, becoming entirely deformed by each other's gravitational pull. They merge, some matter is flung out. You get these very high frequency oscillations in the star. And then eventually they collapse to form a black hole. Right now. And so there's been an ongoing community-wide effort to use these kinds of calculations to make detailed predictions of the gravitational waves from these systems, as well as what kind of electromagnetic counterparts they might give rise to, you know, for different parameters, including different masses and equations of state, and so on. However, for the purposes of this talk, I actually want to discuss some different questions that can be addressed using the same tools. So first of all, I wanted to sort of zoom out and ask sort of a bigger picture question, which is, how can I actually use Einstein's equations to make predictions for situations like we just saw, where you have gravitational collapse happening and singularities forming? So I'll discuss the case. I'll discuss in detail whether or not we should always expect that to happen. This is a topic that goes by the name of cosmic censorship. The second question I want to address is how we can use gravitational waves to teach us something about fundamental physics. So there are a number of different possibilities for this. For example, by studying neutron star mergers, we can learn about the behavior of matter at extreme densities. But the particular example I want to focus on is using black holes as particle detectors, and in particular, discussing the phenomenon known as super radiance. And then briefly at the end, I will turn to neutron stars. So let's jump into this first question regarding cosmic censorship. So unhalted gravitational collapse and general relativity sort of generically gives rise to regions where the space-time curvature blows up and the equations break down. However, it's, we just saw an example of that in the two neutron stars merging and forming a black hole. Remarkably, however, it's conjectured that if we exclude regions that are hidden from faraway observers by black hole horizons, then Einstein's theory generically retains its predictability. So as we just saw in that example, if we ignore the interior of the black hole, we can continue on using Einstein's equations to tell us what happened in the aftermath of the merger, what the gravitational waves are, what the any matter that escaped does is. And so this conjecture is actually due to Roger Penrose, and it goes by the name of weak cosmic censorship. And there's also a strong version of this conjecture, which I won't discuss at all. So if this conjecture actually turns out to be true, it's a very non-trivial and maybe even surprising statement. So for example, we know that cosmic censorship can be violated in Einstein gravity in space-time dimensions that are higher than 4. So for example, in higher than 4 space-time dimensions, you can have black strings or black rings that are unstable to actually pinching down and forming naked singularities. So Louise and Franz Martorius were the first ones to show that. You can also violate cosmic censorship or, if you have finely tuned configurations, as Matt Chopchick showed us by studying critical collapse. So that's why the reason why this word generic is usually included when you state cosmic censorship. However, if we restrict ourselves to 4-dimensional space-time and generic configurations, cosmic censorship has actually been found to be remarkably robust and hold in practically every situation where it's been studied. However, going back to the 90s, there has been one outstanding claim in literature that, of a violation of cosmic censorship that's persisted for almost 30 years. So here's an article from the New York Times in March 1991. Computer defies Einstein's theory. Findings of simulation stun scholars who consider the results impossible. And if we read down, a supercomputer at Cornell University simulating a tremendous gravitational collapse in the universe has startled and confounded astrophysicists by producing results that should not be possible. And scientists say the simulation may have exposed a flaw in at least one aspect of Einstein's theory on the behavior of space-time, or maybe not. So what is this article talking about, and what kind of numerical relativity result do you need to get an article in the Sunday Times? So that newspaper actually referred to this paper here, Formation of Naked Singularities, the Violation of Cosmic Censorship by Shapiro and Tucholsky. So in this paper, they studied the collapse of spheroidal clouds of collisionless particles, or as the Times referred to them, football-shaped clouds, And in particular, they were looking at solutions of the Einstein-Vlasov equations. And in the next slide, I'll go a little bit more into the details of what those are. But they claimed that during the collapse of these spheroidal clouds, they actually were giving rise to a naked singularity that violated cosmic censorship. And the evidence they put forth was that during the collapse, they observed the curvature to blow up in a vacuum region outside the collapsing cloud. So in particular, this is not just due to the matter forming a caustic. I'll say a little bit more about that. At least as far as they were able to follow the calculation, they found no apparent horizon. And if they looked at null geodesics in the vicinity of this blow up, the null geodesics seemed like they were escaping out to infinity. They were not turning around. So just to say a little bit more about the system of matter that we're considering, these are solutions to the Einstein-Vlasov equations, also known as the collisionless Boltzmann equations. So we have the Einstein tensor coupled to this stress energy tensor here, where F is a distribution function both over a space-time coordinate and over momentum space. So you have to integrate over momentum space to get the stress energy at every point. And this distribution function is just invariant along geodesics. So you can just think of it as tracking a system of particles that each follow geodesics and then affect the space-time through the stress energy tensor. And so, of course, this is the same matter model that people who do structure formation calculations use to model cold dark matter. And it's also the same as a dust or pressureless fluid, at least as long as we restrict ourselves to configurations where the velocity is single valued at any given point. However, as this sort of standard example from structure formation shows, you can start out with an initially single valued velocity distribution. And then during the collapse, it can develop a caustic. That's a point where the density blows up. And so the fluid description breaks down, but the Vlasov description is perfectly fine still. And if you integrate past, now the velocity becomes, you get multi-stream regions where you have different velocity at the same point. And in particular, we're not going to consider such matter caustics to be a violation of cosmic censorship, because there's really no problem integrating past these. And if we wanted to smooth out this caustic, we could always just add a little bit of velocity dispersion to our initial conditions. So now returning to the spheroidal clouds that Spiro and Dukulski were considering. So they can actually be parameterized by two different numbers. One is what I'll call B, which is the length of the semi-major axis. And we can normalize that in units of the total mass. And so the case they were considering where they claimed a violation of cosmic censorship corresponded to B equals 10m, so a pretty relativistic case. And the second parameter is the eccentricity, which is given by the ratio of the semi-minor, the length of the semi-minor axis to the semi-major axis. And they considered a case with an eccentricity of 0.9, so a fairly prolate case. So why were Shapiro and Tucholsky considering these prolate clouds, and why did they think they might lead to a violation of cosmic censorship? So the reason for this is because it actually, by setting these configurations, you're actually pitting cosmic censorship against another conjectured rule governing gravitational collapse. And that's one due to Kip Thorne that goes by the name of the hoop conjecture. So the hoop conjecture states that if I have some matter region containing a mass m, then that mass m should form a black hole if and only if I can take a hoop of circumference 4 pi m and pass that hoop over the matter region such that it entirely contains it in every direction. In particular, if I have a very elongated matter region such that the hoop doesn't fit in one direction, like in cylindrical collapse, for example, then hoop conjecture says you should not form a black hole. So Shapiro and Dukulski thought by sort of considering these very elongated configurations, they would collapse. The Hoop conjecture would say you wouldn't form a black hole, and therefore you would violate cosmic censorship eventually.
Probably wrong, but the aspect ratio not like 30%. That's probably aspect ratio is like 30%. A by B is like 30%.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I'll show you some pictures of it. Yeah.
So it's like a football, not a soccer.
Yeah, depends who whose football you're thinking of. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Cornell's in the US.
Yeah, so this work by Shapiro and Tucholsky attracted a lot of attention in literature. Has something like over 300 citations. And there's a number of follow-up works, including using higher resolution, extending beyond axisymmetry, and so on. But a definitive answer to whether cosmic censorship is violated in this situation has remained elusive. So sort of in the spirit of how Disney is remaking classic animated films from the 90s, here, and sort of adding better special effects, making them more appealing to the kids. Here I'm gonna revisit this problem using some modern numerical GR techniques, including a different gauge, adaptive mesh refinement, and so on, and hopefully provide a more satisfying ending.
More politically correct.
Yeah. So just to jump to the punchline, the main result I find is that in all cases studied, the final state of the collapse is a black hole plus gravitational radiation. So cosmic censorship is saved.
So does that mean the Hoop conjecture is also disproven here?
Nope. So actually, both of them are fine. So I'll show you how that happens. Yeah, so let's jump right to the results. So, that's how football shaped they are.
Give you a round specific football.
Yeah, so I'm going to show you a sequence of simulations with different values of the semi-major axis that's labeled in the top corner. And so I'm showing you the density in the matter that's in this sort of yellow magenta color scale, and I'll also show you the gravitational waves in like a blue-gray color scale. So we start with a very small semi-major axis that almost immediately collapses to form a black hole. So this is the apparent horizon in gray. So now we can consider a larger value of B, and then you get collapse again, forming a black hole. And then this is the case that Shapiro and Tucholsky consider. So you can see it collapse both along the axis and perpendicular to the axis, and again, you get a black hole that settles down to a spherical shape. And so for fun, we can consider even larger values of the semi-major axis. So it sort of starts off less relativistic, but eventually, again, collapses down in both directions. And here you get some strong gravitational radiation that's shown here as this black hole settles down. And why not? Let's consider an even bigger one.
It's worth doing. It's worth overdoing.
At some point, we're all going to fall into the black.
There's are there caustics forming?
Yeah, I'll get to that. So again, that eventually collapses, and you get even stronger gravitational radiation. But again, a black hole forms.
So are these two plus one dimensional, or is that fully three dimensional?
Yeah, so I'm enforcing axisymmetry here. Yeah. Yeah, so we can take a look at the how elongated these apparent horizons are that form, so to see if they sort of violate the Hoop conjecture or not. So here I'm plotting the proper circumference of the apparent horizons when they form. The dashed lines correspond to the equatorial circumference, and the solid lines correspond to the polar circumference. And I'm normalizing by 4 pi times the mass, and the mass is just measured from the area of the horizon. So this sort of tells you how far above or below the hoop conjecture bound these horizons are. And so what you can see is that the horizons actually aren't extremely elongated. So this hoop conjecture is only supposed to be sort of a rough approximate inequality. So we won't take this sort of 20% excess as a serious violation. And you can see that for the smaller values of the semi-major axis, you get black holes forming quicker. And those are actually the more elongated ones. And then for the larger values, they're actually less distorted. And then you can see sort of a ringing as these horizons settle down to a spherical shape. You can also see this ringing in the gravitational radiation. So here I'm showing the gravitational wave luminosity from a couple of different cases. So the peak gravitational wave luminosity actually occurs right around the appearance of an apparent horizon. And then you get this quasi-normal ringing as the horizon settles down. And you can see that for some of these cases, the gravitational radiation is actually quite high. It's sort of comparable to a black hole merger. And you're actually emitting quite a lot of gravitational or a lot of energy in gravitational waves. For this most extreme case, it's about 1.5% of the total mass of the spacetime. And that's quite a lot, especially for an axisymmetric spacetime. So for comparison, if I consider two equal mass black holes that are free falling from infinity and colliding head on, that only releases about 0.06% of the total mass in gravitational waves. Yeah, so let's take a closer look at what's going on in the case that Shapiro and Jakulski were claiming a violation of cosmic censorship. So in particular, I'm plotting here the square root of the Kretschmann scalar, which you get by contracting the Riemann tensor with itself. And what you can see is that as a function of time, it actually does blow up. However, in contrast to Shapiro and Jakulski, which claimed the blow up of the curvature in the vacuum region, what I actually find is that it occurs within the matter region. And in fact, you can see that it actually just tracks the increase in density shown by this curve here. And then it saturates at some resolution-dependent maximum. And the point where the maxima for the Kretschmann scalar and the density occur are actually the same point as depicted in this plot here. So we have density on the left and the square root of the Kretschmann scalar on the right. And you can see that the caustic is right there. So what is happening is indeed that you're forming a caustic in the matter. But of course, there's no problem just integrating geodesics through that. So we continue the evolution for a little while longer, an apparent horizon forms. And then if we exclude the interior of the horizon, basically there's no matter left over, which is why you have the rapid decrease here. And the curvature outside the horizon settles to just the value you'd expect for an isolated black hole.
So if you have infinite resolution, do you get
In some sense you would, but you could also, but in some sense that's just the artifact of the matter. So if you wanted to get rid of that, you could also just add like a small velocity dispersion to your initial conditions or something like that. Yeah.
So do you know exactly what mistake Shapiro and Jakulski?
I can't say exactly what happened there. I mean, so I am using sort of a different gauge or coordinates than they are. At least in my gauge, it does seem like this caustic formation occurs at around the same time and place where they were claiming the blow up and curvature. So it's possible that, when somehow they were smearing this caustic so that it appeared in the vacuum region. But I mean, it's also possible that there are differences with the gauges that were used or something like else. Yeah, so in conclusion, we no longer have to be startled and confounded. It looks like the final state of spherical collapse is in fact a black hole, and neither cosmic censorship nor the hoop conjecture is actually violated. The dynamics of the system actually unfolds in such a way that the matter collapses enough in both directions where a horizon can form around it. You censor the sort of final stages of collapse that isn't too elongated and therefore doesn't violate the hoop conjecture. And the sort of violent dynamics of this unfolding are imprinted in the strong gravitational radiation you get from the different cases.
What is generically good enough?
So
when you mentioned Chubtuk's finely tuned problem.
Mm-hmm.
Why is generically okay good enough?
I mean, I guess that's somewhat a matter of opinion. I mean, so obviously, if you don't have the word generic, and then we already have a example of a violation. So,
you declare victory, but maybe you move the goal line. Because we know there's a violation. Why? Maybe that's philosophical question.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, like, I guess, I mean, sort of physically speaking, you are more interested in generic situations than sort of measure zero sets of initial conditions as well.
But I have a kind of another objection to this, because I mean, 20 years ago, or was it 30 years ago, they did a simulation, they say they did it right, and they found they violated it, and now you say you did it, and then it doesn't violate, maybe 20 years from now, somebody else does it. And it's not we do violate it. How can we converge that way? That's not the way.
Maybe you can make a comment. Yeah. I think we've just been too nice. I don't think we did right.
But that's why I asked them. What did they do?
Yeah, but you can look at the paper, and they were working at the extreme of what they were able to resolve, and you don't see a trend towards a convergence answer. And so there.
Okay, so that would be the thing to exactly point out what they did wrong.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. I mean, I think in this, I try to make a convincing case that sort of everything is under control and you understand what's happening. And I think in their case, it's harder to argue that if things are blowing up that you sort of know what happens after that.
Yeah. So well, if you compute the contraction of the Weyl tensor instead of the Riemann tensor, right? So if you get rid of the Ricci part, do you still expect it will blow up?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you're saying if you could just sort of subtract out the matter contribution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand what. Is it entirely contributed by the matter part or?
Yeah, but. I'm not sure exactly how you do that. But I mean, so here I just sort of try to argue that if you look at the scaling of the density or whatever, it sort of exactly matches the slope of curvature. So it is just what you'd expect from the matter contribution. But I'm not exactly sure how you sort of subtract off all the matter contribution part. Yeah, so I want to switch gears now a little bit and address my second topic, which is how we can use gravitational waves to look for new particles. So it actually turns out that in addition to, you know, censoring the singularities that you form from gravitational collapse and allowing us to retain the predictability of Einstein equations, we can actually use black holes as particle detectors as well. So normally we think of, when we think of searching for new particles, we think of, you know, building colliders that go to higher and higher energies to look for more and more massive particles, which may be strongly coupled to, you know, ordinary standard model matter. However, it's also interesting to think of looking in sort of the complementary part of our parameter space, where one might find sort of new physics that's at very low mass or energy scales, but that is very weakly coupled to the standard model matter. That would be things like axions, dark photons, or other kinds of dark matter. And so I'm going to discuss how we can actually look for ultralight bosons that without sort of making any assumptions besides the fact that they gravitate, like we think all matter does. So in order to do this, let's first discuss a phenomenon of black holes that goes by the name of super radiance. So if you consider a wave impinging on a spinning black hole with some frequency omega, so this wave could be an electromagnetic wave, it could be a gravitational wave, but if we calculate, so this wave is carrying a flux of energy and angular momentum, if we calculate how that flux of energy and angular momentum will change the mass, or sorry, change the area of the black hole, then we get an expression proportional to what I have written here. We have one term that's given by the change in mass of the black hole, and then you have this second term, we have one minus the ratio of the horizon frequency of the black hole to the frequency of the wave omega. And that's just multiplied by m, which is the azimuthal number of the wave. So if we stare at this for a second, what we realize is that if the frequency of the impinging wave is below a certain threshold, then this second term will actually be negative. However, black holes have a fundamental property, which is that the area of the horizon can never decrease, it can only increase. In the language of black hole thermodynamics, that's because the area of the black hole plays a role of entropy. And so that's the black hole version of the second law. What that means, though, is that if this second term is negative, the first term had better be negative as well. So the mass of the black hole actually has to decrease as well because it's imparting energy and angular momentum onto the wave. And so that's what's known as super radiance. And there's actually quite a lot of energy that could, in principle, be released from a rotating black hole in this way. For example, for a maximally rotating black hole, if you just look at the difference in the total mass of the black hole from the irreducible mass, which is proportional to the square root of the area of the black hole, so that's the part that you can never decrease, you actually get something like 29% of the black hole's mass could be, in principle, liberated this way. So here's just a demonstration of super radiance in action. We have a spinning black hole and a strong incoming gravitational wave in blue, which creates this outgoing gravitational wave in red. And because this the frequency of the wave is in the super radiant regime, this scattering process is actually 120% efficient. So if you compare the outgoing energy to the incoming, you can calculate this efficiency. But you could also just look at how the mass of the black hole changes before and after the scattering process, because it's the rotational energy of the black hole is actually powering this. So in that case, the gravitational wave interacts once and then just dissipates away. But just for the sake of a thought experiment, let's imagine putting a mirror around this black hole so that the wave is reflected back, interacts again, grows by another amplification factor, balances out the mirror, grows again, and so on until we get an exponentially growing gravitational wave that becomes so strong it explodes through the mirror and creates what Preston Tucholsky called a black hole bomb. So this idea that they came up with of sort of weaponizing black holes languished for a while due to lack of a suitably large mirror to put around astrophysical black holes. But it turns out there is a way to realize this, and that is if instead of having massless bosons, you have massive bosons. So massive bosons can actually form bound states that sit around spinning black holes and continuously interact with them. So if their frequency is in the super radiant regime, they'll actually grow exponentially. And that means that we can use black holes as sort of particle detectors to look for ultralight bosons whose Compton wavelength is comparable to an astrophysical black hole. So this is a way to look for things like axions, dark photons, or so on. They're particles that particle physicists are interested in. And so this is stuff that a number of people, including Mina, have worked on. So just to show you the super radiance instability in action, here I'm showing you the energy density in a massive vector field around a spinning black hole. And you can see it's slowly growing. The one thing to note about this instability is that the growth time scale is actually long compared to the oscillation time scale. So said another way, the imaginary part of the frequency is very small compared to the real part of the frequency. So over many oscillations, this cloud grows from some small value to become quite massive and then eventually saturates. And you can't really see it from this visualization, but not only is the energy in the cloud changing, but the space-time is changing as well. So we can see that plotted here. So in this plot on the left, I'm showing you the energy in the cloud. That's these blue lines. And plotted on top of those are these dashed black lines, which actually show you the change in the black hole's mass. And these different cases just correspond to different values of the boson mass. So you can see that the energy in the cloud is increasing exponentially. And you know, as one might expect, the black hole's loss of mass is tracking that pretty much exactly. And then this exponential period persists for a while and then eventually levels off. And it's actually this change in the black hole space-time that's responsible for this, you know, saturation, this instability. What's happening is, as the black hole loses rotational energy, it actually starts to spin slower and slower. So that's depicted in this plot on the right here, where I'm just plotting the frequency of the black hole horizon. That's the blue curve. And then these dashed red lines are the frequency that the cloud is oscillating at. You can see that the black hole spins down, spins down, spins down until its horizon frequency begins to match the oscillation frequency of the cloud. At that point, the supereddence condition becomes saturated and the instability shuts off. And you can see that in some cases, we're getting quite a lot of the black hole's mass, order 10% that we're taking out of the black hole and putting it into the cloud. So at saturation, we have this cloud oscillating around a black hole. The frequencies match each other. And as one might expect, that actually gives rise to gravitational waves. So as shown here, you basically get gravitational waves at twice the oscillation frequency of the cloud. And at first blush, they're rather simple. They're essentially just monochromatic, and the amplitude is only very slowly changing. We can take a closer look at the gravitational waves as I've shown here. So this is the amplitude of the gravitational waves as a function of time. So as the cloud mass increases, the gravitational radiation increases as well. And then as that saturates, the gravitational wave amplitude levels off. And then it's hard to see here, but on much longer time scales, the cloud will actually dissipate away due to gravitational waves. The amplitude begins to go down again. And this zoom in here shows that it's predominantly just at one frequency that's given by twice the oscillation frequency of the cloud. However, we can also notice from this zoom in here that you can see some small lower frequency modulation to this or beating signal. So the reason that's happening is because there's actually a whole set of unstable modes, which similar to guitar strings we can label as a fundamental mode and an overtone mode. And actually for some parameters of black hole mass and spin and boson mass, the overtone mode can actually grow faster through superradiance compared to the fundamental mode. And so an example of that's depicted here, where this region of yellow parameter space and black hole mass and spin corresponds to the region where the overtone mode would go fastest. And then this orange region corresponds to harder parameter space where the fundamental mode goes fastest. And this gray trajectory actually shows the evolution of a black hole through this as it undergoes superradiance. So the point is that you would actually get different modes simultaneously populated. So this actually comes from some work done by Neil Simonson, who's a PhD student here. And we actually made use of some techniques for actually solving these massive vector field equations on black hole space lines that David Kubizniak and his collaborators came up with. So when you have these, as you know from your wave class, you know that when you have different modes with slightly different frequencies overlapping each other, they give rise to a beating signal or a modulation that's at a much lower frequency. And so that's what you can actually see in the gravitational waves. So one promising way to go out and look for or to rule out these ultralight bosons is to look for gravitational wave signals with instruments like LIGO. So one can look for a stochastic background of gravitational waves from a whole population of spinning black holes undergoing this instability, or one could hope to go after particular sources. In particular, you know, we know one good way to create a spinning black hole is to merge two black holes together as an LIGO merger event. And so you can imagine following up those events to look for subsequent gravitational waves from one of these boson clouds. So this plot on the left shows how different boson masses map to different gravitational wave frequencies. So an instrument like LIGO, which is sensitive roughly to roughly from 50 to 1,000 hertz, would be able to probe ultralight bosons with masses of something like 10 to the minus 12 to 10 to the minus 11 electron volts. And so one interesting thing is that, in particular for these ultralight vector bosons, in comparison to the scalar bosons, so their instability time scales are actually much shorter, and their gravitational radiation is much stronger. So you can see for some of the parameters, these clouds can actually dissipate on time scales that can be as short as hours. And so that means they would actually fall intermediate between sort of the long continuous wave searches LIGO does, where you assume the signal lasts basically your whole year-long observing run, and the shorter merger signals, which one thinks of being on timescales of seconds or minutes. And so this actually motivates new search strategies, where we can now use the fact that we sort of quantitatively understand exactly what gravitational wave signals to expect from these to go after them. So that's something we're working on in collaboration now. So hopefully stay tuned for more results on that. So now I want to, in the last couple of minutes, return to neutron stars and talk about how they might actually be a way to look for dark matter. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, since the part of the gravitational wave signal corresponding to the merger of two neutron stars is at two high frequencies for LIGO to see. You can see that in this spectrogram of the first event where the merger would happen up somewhere up here where you kind of lose the signal and the noise. We can ask the question, how do we know that gravitational wave signal that we think corresponds to two neutron star merging actually doesn't correspond to an event involving a black hole? So of course, it's natural to assume that if we see an object whose mass is roughly one or two solar masses, that it's a neutron star and not a black hole, because we've seen neutron stars with those masses. We haven't seen a black hole with that mass. However, we can use this new tool of gravitational wave astronomy to revisit this assumption, which might have been biased by our previous observations, as I mentioned a couple other examples of that happening already. So just as just for fun, I want to talk about one maybe exotic mechanism which could give you a black hole that has the same mass as a neutron star. Particle physicists have studied certain models of dark matter, in particular asymmetric ones that don't easily self-annihilate, and shown that through a combination of the gravitational pull and then scattering off nucleons in the neutron star, you can actually collect these dark matter particles at the center of a neutron star, and they can build up high enough densities to collapse to form a tiny black hole. We're talking something on the order of 10 to the minus 8 times the mass of the star. A related scenario would be if some fraction of the dark matter were actually made up of primordial black holes with similarly small masses. So in either case, you'd end up with a scenario that I'm calling an endoparasitic black hole. And so you're supposed to think of the chest bursting creature from Alien with the black hole eating up the neutron star from the inside. And so these endoparasitic black holes have been invoked as a way of explaining a number of different astrophysical puzzles, ranging from fast radio bursts to the so-called missing pulsar problem. I won't go into all the details of that. I'll just focus on one, which is the idea that if one of these endoparasitic black holes were to eat up a rapidly rotating neutron star, it could actually eject some of the dense neutron star material and give rise to an optical kilonova signal, like we saw from the first neutron star merger event, and give rise and be a source of heavy elements. So whether or not that happens actually crucially depends on sort of the very relativistic dynamics and redistribution of angular momentum in the final stages of this black hole eating up the neutron star. So that's something that Louise and I looked into recently. So I'm showing you here two different simulations of rotating neutron stars. This is the one with a period of about 2 milliseconds. And this is an even more rapidly rotating one near the maximum rotation allowed before breakup. And so I'm showing here the density, and here is a zoom in to convince you that there is in fact a black hole at its center. And you can see that, and so we're looking at sort of the final milliseconds as the black hole goes being sort of a hundredth of the mass of the neutron star, eating up the whole thing. And what we actually find is that the black hole actually obtains a non-negligible spin, induces differential rotation of the star, and basically none of the matter escapes. So there's no unbound matter, no accretion disk, which might give you an optical signal. There is some gravitational radiation, but it tends to be sort of wimpy and at high frequencies. So you might only hope to see it in our galaxy or nearby. But sort of a robust prediction that we find here is that you know, at the end, you have a black hole that has the same mass and angular momentum as the neutron star that it ate. We can just returning to this question, you know, how, if you see a neutron star merger gravitational wave signal, how do you know it did not involve a black hole? So it turns out it's actually quite difficult. So sort of the leading order effect and the part of the gravitational wave signal that LIGO does see of having a neutron star instead of a black hole is that the neutron star gets tidally deformed by its companion, and the merger happens a little bit quicker than if you just had a black hole. So LIGO has not yet been able to measure these tidal deformations yet. They only have upper bounds. But even if you were able to measure it, there's actually a degeneracy due to our lack of knowledge of the neutron star's equation of state, you know, where you could get the same effect as you have in a 2-neutron star system just by replacing 1-neutron star with a black hole and making the 2nd neutron star a little bit bigger. And so this plot on the right is just showing you that you'd only sort of need to make the neutron star a kilometer or two larger in radius to get the same effect. So until we sort of understand the neutron star equation of state better, sort of still be this ambiguity. And if you do happen to see an electromagnetic transient, you know, then there could be all kinds of differences depending on whether or not you had a black hole. But right now, our sort of understanding of the mechanisms giving rise to these transients is not quite good enough to distinguish. And so that's really another one area where our theorists sort of need to do more work to completely understand these systems to sort of meet the challenges of multi-messenger astronomy. So let me just conclude there and say that, you know, of course, the first few observations of gravitational waves are very exciting, but all signs point to many more to come. And hopefully we'll have more exceptional cases as time goes on. You know, maybe things like some systems that have some orbital eccentricity or have high black hole spin or neutron star spin. You know, a single observation of one of those systems would tell us a lot about the mechanisms that gave rise to them. We'll also have sort of more chances to probe fundamental physics, to explore the behavior of matter at extremely high densities, and maybe get some new information about matter that has so far remained dark. And then, of course, you know, the most exciting thing is to just see something that no one had the imagination to think up before, and that'll send us all back to our chalkboards and simulations to try to explain. So thank you.
So as usual, we start with questions first, students.
The recent gravity neutron star merger event, they have mass about 3 solar mass. Yeah, but up to my knowledge, you tell me that there are no equilibrium state super so massive neutron star, right?
Oh, so sorry, the 3.4 solar masses is the total mass of the system.
Oh, total mass.
For the two neutron stars, yeah.
Questions from anyone?
So, the idea that we would distinguish these, would you call it endoparasitic, the John Hurt black ones, using gravitational waves, would require either what would have been a neutron star black hole merger, but we were just robbed by chance, or a double black hole merger with these small objects. But what would be the odds of having one of these 10 to the minus 8 solar mass black holes wander in, get captured in, create a black hole in one of these systems, and we still have pulsars? How do we thread the needle there?
Yeah, I mean, so I think, I mean, you have to be careful with the parameters you choose for your dark matter in order not to be ruled out by the pulsars that you see. But yeah, I mean, I guess the reason it was invoked for this missing pulsar problem is that it, you know, at the centers of galaxies, that's where you expect that most of the dark matter to be. So maybe that's also getting rid of those. So yeah, but there are already some constraints on these models from the fact that you do see neutron stars and they haven't all been eaten.
Well, we have the magnetar now, so mm-hmm. they can eat it.
I have a question along the same lines, but because you were putting it a bit in a very strong way in your slides, about constraining the presence of small black holes in general. So, but then from what I gather from your talk, it was more about just constraining these merging events. So I don't know if there was something more that I missed or you were not saying about constraining in general in the universe, the presence of those small black holes.
Yeah, well, yes, for that specific project, we're more interested on whether or not you would expect some optical transient or some of these like heavy elements to be unbound from this happening. And you know, in fact, what we found is that you wouldn't. So in fact, that's not a good way to rule out these systems.
So when you collapse your blobs of matter, is there any total angular momentum to form a black hole? Or
sorry, say that.
Is there a total angular momentum in your simulations when you collapse your blobs of matter to form a black hole?
Are you talking about for the first part of the talk, yeah. The cosmic censorship? No, in those cases there was no angular momentum.
But it's very difficult to add angular momentum, I guess, right? Because
those are in axisymmetry, but you could have uniform angular momentum and that would be fine. Yeah, but
wouldn't you expect actually there to have, you know, violation of cosmic symmetry or whatever?
No, I don't think you'd expect by adding. If you added angular momentum, that would sort of tend to resist the collapse, right? The centrifugal barrier, right? But yeah, I think Preston Tucholsky did actually consider some. Shapiro and Tucholsky did actually consider some. Case with angular momentum and found something similar. But those did not involve angular momentum.
So you served a very nice picture of a gravitational wave coming in, going out with more energy, extracted energy from the spin of a black hole.
Yeah.
And somebody tried to model that interaction by treating a black hole as a particle. Because black holes basically are elementary particles, will be very big ones. They have mass and spin and so on.
Right.
And so you have a linear wave coming in, interacting with this massive particle going out. There should be some vertex which describes that. So there's so many constraints on the.
Right, right, yeah. I mean, so like sort of the original way people calculate this was solving the so-called Tucholsky equation, right? And then you can get the amplification factor from
fixed black hole background.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
But you're talking about sort of adding nonlinear effects on top of that?
Yeah.
No, I don't know that anyone's tried to do a calculation of the nonlinear effects.
Effective field theory. Black hole gravity.
Yeah, so I know some work that's been done to like use effective field theory techniques to calculate super radiance. So I don't know of any that have gone beyond the test field or like the or linearized gravity around a black hole?
Yeah, the full process should be described in that way.
Yeah, I think in principle.
What's the typical gain factor in a one passage super radiant interaction? How much more amplitude is going out?
I mean, so that in that one I showed you, it was like 1.2, so you gained 20% more energy. Yeah, so.
Could we imagine seeing, I'm going to be careful about saying this so close to Nash, gravitational wave echoes associated with scattering of gravitational waves off of spinning black holes along, you know, roughly along the line of sight or in, near the line of sight?
Yeah, I mean, so.
Sorry.
So I guess in that approximation, it's more like a plane wave that's hitting the the black hole, right? And so there, you definitely don't get these huge like amplification factors. They're more for like the incoming one that's you somehow have conspired to focus in on the black hole, right? So, I mean, you sort of get the most from these like lower spherical harmonics. Like that was the L equals M equals 2 one.
Hard to do that in nature.
Yeah.
I was a bit confused about the Hoop conjecture violation. At first, I thought the Hoop conjecture was about the initial matter configuration, but it seemed to me you're saying that the initial matter configuration can violate the bound, and it collapses to a matter distribution that satisfies it before becoming a black hole.
Yeah, exactly.
So was I wrong that the original Hoop conjecture was not about the actual distribution, but some future?
Yeah, it's just like at any given moment of time, if you want to decide whether or not you should have a black hole, you should just construct this hoop and see if it fits. And if it does, then a black hole should have formed. And if it doesn't, then you should not expect a black hole at that instance in time.
And I'm still confused that if your initial distribution didn't satisfy the Hoop conjecture bound, then shouldn't the conclusion be it won't form a black hole?
Well, yeah, so the idea that Shapiro and Tucholsky had is that, yeah, you have these very elongated things that don't satisfy the Hoop conjecture bound, and if they collapse while remaining elongated, then you could get a naked singularity. But what I found is that basically the collapse occurred in such a way that they eventually became sufficiently compact where they could form a black hole without violating the Hoop conjecture. The Hoop conjecture is not about the initial conditions because you can always collapse down, make things more compact.
That's what I'm asking. So what is the Hoop conjecture about exactly, if not about the initial conditions? How could you phrase it more precisely?
It's just that at any given moment of time, if you want to decide at that time, is there a black hole or not, then you apply this conjecture, this Hoop conjecture bound.
It's a second, just a follow up. Would there be initial configurations you could study that would not form a black hole because they, you know, violate the Hoop conjecture? But you didn't give any examples of things that failed to form a black hole, but presumably we know that it's an infinitely long configuration which would not. So.
Right. Yeah. So you could consider like more and more elongated ones, and eventually you sort of approach the Newtonian limit where it's not really strong field gravity, but you are getting sort of cylindrical collapse, and there you won't get any black holes.
Could you go to the plot where you showed what sort of the Hoop conjecture region was, and then there are wiggles around that, and you said we had a comment that we shouldn't take these tiny violations of the Hoop conjecture seriously because at the 10% level, one shouldn't care. Is that because the Hoop conjecture is an imprecise thing and because it's applying to Schwarz child radius? Or is that?
Yeah, so it's more sort of a rule of thumb.
Yeah.
There have been some attempts to sort of make it mathematically rigorous, but you need some way to define your hoop and basically you need some sort of way to define this hoop. So what I did here is basically just look at the horizons when they form and look at the proper circumference. But there's also it's only a sort of approximate inequality was claimed anyway. So if you could somehow conspire to make black holes that were like two or three times over the hoop conjecture, or so that you could sort of arbitrarily violate the hoop conjecture, like make them arbitrarily elongated. That would be, I think, a violation of the hoop conjecture. And in fact, you can do that in cases where you have like negative energy density, like anti-de Sitter space or things like that. So there, the hoop conjecture does not hold. But yeah, but I don't think it's
sort of the y-axis there isn't resolution limited in the simulation. Those are real sort of variations around the maximum circumference as compared to 4 pi.
Yeah. So I mean, it's just because it's not completely spherical. It's just oscillating back and forth as it settles down.
Your simulation of the SC black hole eat up the neutron star, nearly nothing goes out, right?
Right, right.
So however, we know the neutron star has very high magnetic field. How about the magnetic field? It will be eat up or eat away?
Yeah, yeah, and that's a very interesting question. So for those calculations, we didn't include the magnetic field. But I mean, you can imagine the neutron star, you know, has some magnetic field, some dipole moment or whatever, and then once it becomes a black hole, it can no longer sustain that, right? So that magnetosphere has to go away. And so you might expect some electromagnetic transit associated with the, you know, the sort of evaporation of that magnetosphere. So that, yeah, that's something we're interested in looking into. Yeah, so Louise did some calculations of similar things and, you know, has some estimates about the kind of like radiation that you might expect from those. But yeah.
Okay, so if no more questions, as usual, we have some snacks in the first floor, and let's thank Will again.